by pressing down a special key and place a little melody.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM-LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Institutes for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences, research, and education. For more than 30 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. I'm also pleased to share with you that the Hamner has significantly increased its contribution to the show and to the station, becoming one of WCOM's golden voices. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Moorhead's monthly Current Science Forums series presents expert speakers and lively discussions of today's science headlines. Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center is online at moorheadplanetarium.org. And last but not least, we are proud to have yet another underwriter in the Radio In Vivo family. Thanks to personal contributions from the faculty, Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Biomanufacturing Research Institute and Technology Enterprise, or BRITE, at North Carolina Central University. BRITE is one of the newest and most innovative biotechnology educational initiatives in the country, and the only formal biotech degree program offered by a North Carolina university. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is one of our leading authorities on the transmission and prevention of HIV/AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases. Dr. Myron S., or Mike Cohen, is the J. Herbert Bates Distinguished Professor of Medicine, Microbiology, and Public Health at the UNC School of Medicine. He is Associate Vice Chancellor of Global Health, and he is Director of the Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases. Mike received his B.S. from the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana and his M.D. from Rush Medical College in Chicago. He holds several other appointments related to his work in infectious diseases and STDs, which we will no doubt discuss. And finally, we should mention that among his many honors, Mike received the 2005 Thomas Perrin Award for Lifetime Achievement in STD Research from the American Sexually Transmitted Diseases Association, the ASTDA, and in 2008, he received the O. Max Gardner Award, the highest honor for a UNC faculty member from the Board of Governors, which recognizes faculty who have made the greatest contributions to the welfare of the human race. So with that in mind, Mike, it's an honor and a privilege to welcome you to Radio In Vivo.
Good morning.
I'd like to spend a good bit of our time together today talking about some of your ideas with regard to HIV/AIDS and some of the programs you're involved with. To begin the discussion, would you set the scene for us in terms of where we stand currently with HIV/AIDS, both in terms of treatment and the disease's prevalence?
Well, let's start with prevalence. I've been working on this problem for the entire 30 years of the epidemic, and we started out with a very small number of cases recognized in the United States in 1980. Mm-hmm. And now in 2009, our most recent data suggests that there are about 33 million people worldwide with HIV infection, about a million in the United States. 16 million have died. 2.5 million died last year worldwide. And there are about 2.5 million new infections a year. So this is a highly prevalent infection.
Sure.
It's not equally distributed. We I think, rightly would focus a lot on our domestic problem in our discussions today, but on a global basis, about 80% of the cases are in sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. India, Russia, and China represent the places in the world of greatest future concern.
I see.
Your second question is about treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's obviously a critical question. If you look at this, again, from UNC's point of view, in 1984-85, when we were seeing a kind of a maximal number of sick people as inpatients, we developed an inpatient ward. And at that time, about more than 10% of all the admissions to UNC Hospital had HIV infection.
Wow.
And we had many deaths a week at mm-hmm. UNC hospitals.
Sure.
In 89-90, we were given the gift of the first antiretroviral drug. Now there are 22 drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as those...
Which we should recognize was emerged from research right here.
That's right, developed mm-hmm. in Burroughs Wellcome.
Yeah.
And with those 22 drugs, so even in the mid-1990s, we have curves that demonstrate with the introduction of those drugs in the United States, death became a fairly rare event. And HIV became a chronic disease. In the United States, our big problem insofar as treatment is concerned is in creating an environment where people get tested early in the disease, where we can make the greatest contribution to their health. The state of North Carolina, which is a really great leader in all HIV activities, has a campaign that you've seen on television probably called the Get Real, Get Tested campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a great effort to identify people before they suffer the grave consequences of unremitting HIV infection. With early treatment, as I said, we really convert this into a chronic infection that's managed in our outpatient clinics. And UNC is taking care of about 5,000 patients around the state. Now, the worldwide situation is improving, but still a concern. Of worldwide, if there are 30 more than 30 million people infected, at least 7, 8, 10 million need therapy now. Only about 3 million are receiving therapy. And in 2000, no one was receiving therapy outside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go in terms
sure.
of making treatment available worldwide.
Now, I know that there have been some I do want to get back to that very topic in much more detail and talk about some of the Africa programs and things like that. But just in terms of what's out there now and what's on the horizon in terms of treatment, I know that there have been some disappointments recently, you know, with regard to development of a vaccine and with gels that were hoped to be used to prevent HIV transmission, that some of those studies have not worked out as well as would be hoped. Where do those types of... maybe setbacks is too strong a word, maybe it isn't. Where do those problems put us at this point? Are we...
Okay. So what you're really getting into is our strategies for prevention, which
sure.
are very, very detailed. And the failures are often more visible than the successes, which is, I think, true of, you know, almost anything in life. For the vaccine development field, it is a big challenge, and one that's been going on from the beginning, and it's mm-hmm. kind of an ongoing challenge. And the trial you're talking about was conducted with the support of from a vaccine developed by the Merck Pharmaceutical Company based on data that was generated in animals. And that particular vaccine, which was designed to stimulate a particular kind of immunity, it wasn't really designed to prevent HIV infection as much as ameliorate it, change the natural history,
mm-hmm.
that the animal experiments didn't translate into success in humans. So that is a setback. But I should, by way of, I don't want to call it bragging, but by way of public relations, indicate that the triangle is the Center for HIV Vaccine Immunology. So that's a partnership between Duke, UNC, Harvard, Oxford, and Alabama, mm-hmm. with more than 300 scientists working in a virtual center. I have the opportunity to be one of the leaders of that center.
Right.
That
mm-hmm.
center, which is the biggest single NIH award ever granted, more than $380 million. That center is designed to understand what we need to do to enable a vaccine. And we've made a lot of progress. So I think the step backwards is not a giant step backwards. It's a small step backwards. Now, there is success in the other arena. So the other arena, the gel arena you're talking about, is mm-hmm. the field of topical microbicides.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the goal there is to give a woman a product that she would be able to use that would prevent her from acquiring HIV during unprotected sexual intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, we participated, along with many other centers, in the development of a product called Pro 2000. That product, the group reported only in February that this product, Pro 2000, worked. Now, it was imperfect. It allowed a 30% reduction in the acquisition of HIV in all the women in the group, and this is more than several thousand women, but among women who failed to use condoms, it had 80% protection. Now, that's quite important for sub-Saharan Africa because a lot of women want to get pregnant, and within that this trial called HBTN-035, there were more than 650 deliveries. So the product proved safe for mm-hmm. pregnancy.
Okay.
Babies were born normally, and it provided substantial protection. Another trial to further prove the success of this product will be available. The results will be available in November. If the second trial supports the first trial, I think you'll see a flurry of activity of making this product available to women. Now, mm-hmm. this is on the forefront of maybe 10 other topical microbicide products, and the future products are much more potent, are antiviral in nature, and are very likely to be successful.
Okay.
So I think you were on the cusp of a real big set of breakthroughs for women.
Now you're working with the FHI on that? Or?
Yeah, well, there are many, many partners. FHI and Duke and many other organizations are partners in this kind of activity. These are really synergistic, complementary activities.
I see. Well, you mentioned the Center for HIV/AIDS Vaccine Immunology, or CHAVI.
CHAVI.
And you are the director of the Clinical Sites Corps mm-hmm. In that organization. Tell us a little bit more about that organization, because it's a very exciting project, and I understand that the UNC Malawi project is part of that effort.
Right. So CHAVI surfaced about 4 years ago because of frustration of lack of enough basic science enabling technology, enabling ideas to support vaccine development. It was believed at the time that CHAVI was competed and released that in order to make progress in the vaccine field, we had to look to the core of the problem. Because the vaccines were being, many vaccines developed are, and I don't want to say this rudely, a certain amount of luck's involved. That mm-hmm. you see a disease, you look at some immune functions of the disease, you make some vaccine, and by God, a vaccine's developed. And certainly the early vaccines, I could tell you that there was little other than wishful thinking in the very earliest vaccines, but the wishes came true.
Mm-hmm.
HIV's
mm-hmm.
turned out to be an incredibly tougher nut to crack for a whole bunch of reasons. So CHAVI mm-hmm. is not in the business of making a vaccine. CHAVI's in the business of making discoveries that enable the scientific development of a vaccine.
Okay.
So having said that, what happened very quickly in CHAVI was the realization that we needed to see every minute detail of the HIV transmission event. In order to do that, we had to have groups of people all over the world at risk for HIV, and we had to detect their infections and their partners at the moment of infection, as close as possible to the moment of infection. Mm-hmm. What this would do would give us specimens to understand why one person gets infected and another person doesn't get infected, and to see the evolution of immune response that might guide us in development of a vaccine. And so so my job became setting up clinical sites that could undertake this very difficult task. This is finding...
That's very challenging.
It is very challenging.
Yeah.
It is finding needles in haystacks. And I'll give you an example. The state of North Carolina is a site, the entire state. And Duke and UNC enroll patients with these what are called acute infections. These are people who have not seroconverted their antibody. So if they were to go to a clinic and say, do I have HIV infection, it would be invisible to a physician. We have to find these invisible infections. So in finding...
So an HIV test at that point
would be negative. In fact, wow. By definition, we're looking for people who have HIV virus in their blood but have not had an immune response.
Okay.
These are truly needles in haystacks.
So the test detects the immune response.
No, the normal test. The test that you the test we recommend detects people's immune response. They've got what we would call established infection. But we're not looking for established infection. We're looking for people before infection is established.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In order to do that, we found people in North Carolina, several hundred or more than 100, but we've had to screen, and this is going to be a big number, 690,000 people in North Carolina in order to find the more than 100 people we've enrolled. So, and then once we find the person who's infected, we find their partner as quickly as we can, and we move forward with a series of studies that we think contribute to vaccine development.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what about the project in Malawi? I don't want to before we talk about that a little.
Okay, so it's kind of, I need to step back in this conversation. I'm going to have to go back. I have
We're
to go back to 19.
Probably going
to
jump around a little bit.
Well, I tend to try and be linear, but so I've indicated that we're looking for subjects with acute infection.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't accidental that North Carolina and I participated in this grant, because for more than a decade we've been working on strategies to work with subjects with acute infection. So, in fact, I was recruited to be part of CHAVI because of my expertise in this arena, in the transmission biology and in acute infection.
Mm-hmm.
Some of this interest started from our work in Malawi, which began in 1989. And in 1989, we started working there. And we were working there specifically to understand the transmission of HIV as it relates to other sexually transmitted diseases. So we set up a clinic in Malawi in 89 or 90, around that time, studying classical sexually transmitted diseases. And it turned out, we saw very quickly, that if we looked at people with gonorrhea or chlamydia or those common diseases, that for a whole variety of reasons, about half of the people we would see would also have HIV infection. Now, subsequently, we recognized, we made a lot of observations about the relationship between gonorrhea and chlamydia and HIV, as you might expect.
Sure.
But when we looked at the people in our clinic who did not have established HIV infection, pretty readily we could understand that some of them had acute infection. And so we started studying acute infection in Malawi, and that became part of our work. And so this acute infection idea is not new to 2009.
Mm-hmm.
It began many, many years ago.
Okay.
And so in Malawi, we started out with a very small... So then you look at Malawi, we started out with a small staff working on with some USAID funds. And if we fast forward to the current time, we have a fairly massive operation. We have 8 full-time faculty, more than 250 employees, local employees, mm-hmm. About $15 million a year of funding, not all from CHAVI, 19 to 20 different clinical trials we're working on in all areas of treatment and prevention. And Malawi has become one of the key research sites to understand prevention and treatment of global HIV.
I see.
We're partners. We work in the city of Lilongwe, and we're partners with Johns Hopkins University that works in the city of Blantyre, and our third partner is the College of Medicine, which is in Blantyre. So mm-hmm. all of our work is really a tripartite activity with Hopkins, UNC, and the College of Medicine in Malawi.
So it's very much a frontline operation in terms of the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
There's almost nothing there's almost no clinical research result you would see of substantial importance that doesn't involve research done in Malawi, often complementary or part of bigger groups, which mm-hmm. is how this works. You know,
sure.
Almost all trials are multi-center big trials. And Malawi, I think, we're proud of the work we've done. I would also say, on behalf of my other role as a UNC employee, mm-hmm. that we've done a lot both for service and teaching. So we have a dormitory where students live in our dormitory. UNC students live in the dormitory. Some come for a summer. Some live there for a year. We're partners with the College of Medicine in a master's degree program. And we tithe a lot of our
clinical time to the care of about 10,000 patients with HIV that receive care at our clinical site.
Wow. So that's impressive.
It's a very large and impressive operation. And I would say this is not about me. It's about like a lot of people at UNC who put this together over many, many years. And Rose Hoban, who's a local reporter for WNC, I hate to raise another radio station.
That's quite all right. I was ready to do a shout out because I heard her first report.
Right.
This
she's
morning.
Doing a series of stories from Malawi, some of which will include our clinical site. We haven't heard what she has to say yet, but I'm hoping it's favorable.
Well, everybody needs to, if there's an interest there, there's a whole series of reports going on from Malawi that Rose is doing.
And she's got a blog, so if you do the WNC's website, you see her blog and the story she's doing. She's going to Zambia, too, but I'll be curious to see what her opinions are.
Well, I heard the first one just this morning, and it was, as expected, very well done. So, Mike, the operation in Malawi really embodies the mission of the Institute of Global Health and Infectious Diseases in that it encompasses education, research, and outreach all at the same time.
So, again, we have to step back. UNC, one of the priorities of the entire UNC system is globalization. That is one of the highest priorities. It is widely believed by President Bowles and faculty around the 16 campuses that we need to be a global university system. For UNC Chapel Hill, it's one of its five highest priorities, globalization. On campus, you may have seen the Global Education Center, which is a fantastic facility, the FedEx Global Education Center. That is the hub that connects the health sciences campus with the academic affairs campus. And so my role is to help the five health science schools realize their full potential in terms of globalization. And as you said, there are three key missions. Research, we are a research-intensive university, and you can't really be successful in research any longer unless you work on a world stage. We are a key teaching institution, and we have an obligation to our students to let them go abroad and to bring other students here for diversification. And a university this big has a tremendous service obligation. And that service obligation, of course, the highest priority is for the state of North Carolina, but it's got to be realized globally.
Sure.
So those three activities are ongoing. The UNC is very focused on three regions, Asia, and especially China and India, Central America, and especially the Galapagos, Mexico, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, and sub-Saharan Africa, and especially South Africa, Malawi, Madagascar. So it's more focused than you might think.
Sure, I see. Well, it's just amazing to get a picture of what's going on. You think of we live in this kind of insular Chapel Hill world, but there's UNC activities going on in many, many places across the world.
70 countries.
70 actually, countries.
70. Wow. But we do have the RDU flight that goes every night, RDU to London. And from London, you can get anywhere. So you won't get on that plane without seeing a UNC faculty on their way to London about to go somewhere else.
Right. I want to talk more about the Institute and its programs a little bit later, Mike. But in my nonlinear fashion, I would like to continue our discussion about, where we stand with HIV/AIDS and get some of your very interesting ideas about it on the table. To kind of get us started there, what is the current standard of therapy for HIV/AIDS? I know it's changed quite a bit in recent years, and is there a different standard of therapy here in the developed world versus the developing world?
The answer, obviously, in some ways, has to be no. Okay, in other words,
of course,
and actually, this is a very critical time as it relates to therapy. And so I'm going to be a little long-winded to explain this.
No problem.
This will be more long-winded than I would like. We started out with no drugs and a cookbook to take care of people, to take care of infections and neoplasms that surface because of immunosuppression. That's all we had. Mm-hmm. That was not particularly effective. Then we moved to prophylaxis, trying to prevent these opportunistic infections that were unusual in nature. That was okay, but not great. Then we got the drugs. The drugs changed everything, especially if they're given early and the immune response is preserved. But the original drugs were expensive and rationed and toxic. So there became a big debate about don't start these drugs too early in the course of HIV infection because they're expensive and toxic, and there's a cost-benefit ratio. But this was antithetical to how infectious disease people think. We like to cure infections. The reason we went into this specialty is to cure people. We don't like chronic infections. We want acute infections that are gone. So as over time, what's transpired is the drugs have become cheaper, partly because they're made in other countries and generically, and much, much safer. So the current standard worldwide is using three agents in combination, because that avoids resistance, and those three agents are very likely to attack the virus in ways that are going to suppress viremia. And you give three drugs, and we like to start people on the best three agents and develop durable suppression so that the suppression will last for a very long period of time without any need to change drugs. We want to use the least toxic drugs possible. Sure. So this is true in the United States, and it's true everywhere in the world. Now, having said that, now we're coming up on another tension in the field, and this is a very hot topic, and that tension is, when should you start therapy? Mm-hmm. We evolved into a rationing strategy where we follow a parameter called the CD4 count, which is a surrogate of immune function,
right.
And we've delayed giving therapy until the CD4 count falls to a certain level. Mm-hmm. But increasingly, it's believed,
which indicates that illness is starting
when the CD4 count falls to a certain level, the chance of a illness supervening, compromising mm-hmm. health, becomes higher and higher.
Right. Okay.
But increasingly, because the drugs are better and cheaper and safer, increasingly there's a belief that we ought to get rid of our cookbook, and when we find somebody for treatment, we ought to just treat them. And this is called the test and treat strategy. Now, this is important for another reason. When you treat somebody and suppress their viremia, you're not going to cure them, and I'll come back to that in a second. Sure. However, you will suppress their viremia. The transmission probability to the next person is entirely dependent on the concentration of virus available.
Right. So it's widely viral load.
That's why viral load. And so it's widely believed that if you suppress the virus sufficiently, especially in the genital tract, that you will render a person no longer contagious. The Swiss, led by one of my trainees named Pietro Vernazza, made a declaration. And their Swiss declaration said, look, if you suppress somebody sufficiently, they're rendered no longer contagious. So there's a summit meeting at the World Health Organization May 5th to discuss all this. And we're involved in a clinical trial called HBTN-052 to prove or disprove this whole belief system. So it's a pretty interesting time for treatment. Mm-hmm. Now, the other interesting thing about treatment, so the tension is the drugs are great. They're much cheaper. We really render people incredibly healthy if we start the drugs early, and we may even have a prevention benefit if we can find enough people to treat. The next great wave in the HIV treatment field is trying to cure or ameliorate the infection further. Right. One of our faculty, David,
and you actually are one of those rare people that uses that word,
right,
cure.
Right. I think it's really important to use that word.
Mm-hmm.
The cancer field, which I have tremendous respect for, recognized long ago that it's not a bad idea to use the word cure. And they have many, many ways they use that word. And they have many fundraising efforts. They have Race for the Cure, Run for the Cure, Bicycle to the Cure, Swim to the Cure. And I respect that because what they call cure is oftentimes amelioration with follow-up, which is respectful.
Sure, sure.
Now, for the HIV field, we understand this infection. Cancer is many, many different diseases. Their challenge is even greater in some ways in the HIV field. We have only one challenge. That challenge is that during the beginning of the infection, cells acquire HIV and integrate the HIV genetic material into the host genetic material. This forms a pool of cells called the latent pool. Mm-hmm. So when we suppress someone's viremia, if we look hard enough, we can see a little blip of virus coming from this latent pool. The size of the latent pool is not completely appreciated, but it's maybe about one cell. It's one cell in millions of cells. And the challenge to cure HIV is to learn to deal with the latent pool. Now, until 2 years ago, people didn't want to talk about this for a variety of reasons, partly because they thought we were going to make a vaccine. Mm-hmm. And so now, in the last 2 years, the Gates Foundation has a grand challenge grant to cure HIV, and the NIH will soon announce a program of competition for grants to cure HIV. Now, cure may not mean cure in the sense that you're rendered free of the disease and you no longer need antivirals. Cure may be amelioration, so that you can be off antivirals for 10 or 15 years. So we're open to using the word cure the same way that the cancer field would use the word cure, which I have great respect for. So
it's a relative term.
I'm very excited about this, and we have a whole team of people that are working on this, led by a guy named David Margolis, that was recruited specifically to work on this problem.
So are there good newer medications that are being looked at that are on the horizon that may be able to flush out that latency?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the answer, of course, has to be yes.
We hope.
There are agents available, and it's exactly what you said. We have two kinds of options. We have to have a strategy to detect every infected cell and blow it up, or we have to have a strategy to force every cell that's hiding to replicate virus. And once the virus is being replicated, the traditional antiviral agents will work. In addition, we have to make the antiviral agents enter every bodily compartment. Now, you have to go back to the childhood lymphoma field. And when we were first developing strategies to cure childhood lymphomas, we succeeded, except that there was residual disease in the brain and the testes. So we have a group of pharmacologists that are very sensitive to the compartments. So as we work on antivirals, we're also working on making sure the antivirals enter every compartment efficiently. So it's pretty much exactly as you said. We need to search and destroy every infected cell, and that would render the person, quote, cured.
Sure.
Now, I guess I'm going to add one other thing. There has been potentially a cure of AIDS, which of a person with AIDS, and that's an interesting, it's called the German guy. And what happened with the German guy was he was a man who was HIV infected, and he had a viral type that could only use one kind of cell. And he underwent a bone marrow transplant with a stem cell that had that was having a change in the receptor in the stem cell for that kind of virus that he had. When that transplant transpired and the person had a whole new set of cells occupying his body,
a whole new immune system,
HIV could no longer grow. And to date, this guy is, as far as we know, rendered free of visible HIV. So that's an aside. It's not what we're talking about, but it's interesting.
Right.
It demonstrates the potential.
Well, absolutely. I know that gene therapy is possibly one of the things being looked at in this arena.
That's right.
I'm sure a good ways away from any clinic.
Not as far as you think. As I said, the Grant Challenge Grant, I don't know how many there are, they inspire people to have novel and creative ideas. And so do I really believe that in my lifetime we might be able to cure people with HIV? And the answer is yes, cure or ameliorate differently. I'm quite optimistic about that.
That's great. That's great. What about the significant lessons we've been learning from studying individuals with natural resistance to HIV, so-called innate immunity? And I know your colleague, Dr. Margolis, has been working on that.
That is a complicated field. The thing we've learned the most has to do with, first, there's some dispute. Like in any other field, there's got to be a dispute. There are a group of women sex workers in Africa, in Kenya, who have been argued to be somewhat resistant to acquiring HIV. A lot of different immune potential has been ascribed to them, but none of it's ever been proven. These are called the Pumwani sex workers in Kenya. That's never been proven substantially, and it hasn't really led to vaccine development. The hotter topic in immunity has to do with genetics. A guy at Duke who works with the CHAVI named David Goldstein is the leader of our CHAVI genetics group. And
whom I hope to have on this program.
Yeah, David's the leader of the CHAVI genetics group, and he, working with CHAVI and other scientists at other institutions, have all agreed on a few things. There's a general agreement. This will be a little complicated, so I'm going to say it
slow. No problem.
There's a general agreement that there are people with a genetic background. Well, first, let me say resistance to infection is very, very rare. And that's only been ascribed to people with the deletion in a receptor called the CCR5 receptor. Mm-hmm. So people with that deletion can resist infection. And the bone marrow transplant was done with a stem cell that had that deletion in CCR5. So that was the Occam's razor, absolutely proving that CCR5 is really important. Furthermore, we have a drug that blocks CCR5 receptors that can block infection called Maraviroc. So we firmly have established that CCR5 is a big deal.
Okay. Right.
Beyond the CCR5 deletion on the CCR5 receptor, we know of virtually no evidence that anyone else is, quote, resistant to infection. But there's another issue. There are people who control their infection. And controlling your infection is a really good thing, controlling it without drugs. That seems to be ascribed to people with a particular kind of genetic background. And this is the HLA genetic system, and some people with a particular kind of HLA genotype and phenotype, for reasons we don't completely understand, control infection. And what these people do, and David's worked on this as have others, what they do is they force the virus to mutate in a way that makes the virus very unfit. So they're not rendered free of infection, but they're rendered infected with a virus that's so unfit that it replicates poorly. And so if we have a paper coming out that looks at the other side of the coin. If we look at the average person who gets acute infection, they evolve mutants against host defenses so rapidly that they can't, that it's unrestrained viral replication, and the only way you can deal with it is antiviral drugs. Mm-hmm. If you flip it around, the people with just the right genotype, for reasons we don't completely understand, they attack the virus in a way that forces the virus to be unfit. Now, you can imagine for the vaccine field, we're trying to understand every tiny detail of this, because if we can make a vaccine that forces the virus to be unfit, it would be a very successful vaccine.
So it neutralizes the virulence.
I don't want to use that term.
Okay.
Virulence, it reduces the replication potential. So the concentration of virus available in the concentration of replicated virus is small. So there's two benefits. The host would probably have less damage, and the host would be less contagious, because so much less virus would be available to go to the next person. And the virus that went to the next person, at least at first, would be unfit. Now, once it got to the next person, it would probably mutate and become fit again, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we're pretty excited about this whole... This is just... All these discoveries have just occurred in the last year. Literally, I mean, every week there's another kind of notation of information that really lends itself to understanding this.
Well, that's very exciting.
It
Those
is
are
exciting.
Very
and it's all
discoveries.
Also, the other, I guess I'm going to be even more detailed.
Please.
The kind of changes that are being observed from just the right host and just the right viral change are all in one region of the virus. That's another advantage here. Most of it's in what's called the gag region of the virus. And so understanding what makes the virus less fit, this becomes an operational definition of an unfit virus. So you can see the hope. We're not going to prevent infection this way, but we might be able to ameliorate infection to reduce the probability of a transmission event to the next person. So what you can envision is somebody gets infection, and right after infection, there's a process called ramp-up viremia, where the virus is growing unrestrained. And we see the cells kick in and try and fight the virus. And we see mutants escape in days. But in the right genetic background, we don't see that occurring. And so, again, a vaccine that harnesses this information is exactly what Chavi is supposed to do.
I see. Well, it's going to be very interesting to keep an eye on where that's going.
It will probably go fast in a positive direction.
Great. Well, we will, maybe in a year, we'll get together again and hear about all the progress.
There's one other field that we haven't talked about. I'm gonna take the liberty of bringing something up.
Please do.
Because if we're going to look at the big arenas, we've talked about like HIV therapy, where treatment can become prevention if we find enough people to treat. We've talked about vaccines. The other idea is using, and we've talked about topical agents that could prevent acquisition of infection. The other idea is oral agents, the pre-exposure prophylaxis. That's the idea that the antivirals we have, if used in the proper concentration and the right combination, could be taken before exposure. And by taking pill before exposure, you would render yourself resistant to HIV.
Okay.
We call this pre-exposure prophylaxis. There are 21,000 people participating in clinical trials right now. The first clinical trial of this approach will be available next year. We're very optimistic, based on experiments in monkeys, that this is going to work too. Now, how we ration drugs in that arena, who would take pre-exposure prophylaxis, why would they take it? Those are big questions, but we think it's going to work. So you can see the prevention field is moving positively right now.
Well, I know that you've also made the bold claim, I think, that given the right approach and with the right application of these existing methods, we could virtually halt the HIV/AIDS epidemic within a decade. You know, you've proposed universal HIV testing, followed by immediate antiretroviral therapy for anyone who tests positive, could eventually halt the epidemic.
This we would refer to this as utopian modeling.
Right,
so let me be a little circumspect.
Okay.
So actually, we've written about this in a particular way. The World Health Organization is kind of crazed over this right now, led by a guy named Kevin DeCock. He's the director. And Ruben Granich is an investigator there who wrote an editorial or a paper in Lancet that modeled what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And in Ruben's model, it was like, okay, let's test everybody. Let's treat everybody. And in fact, Ruben argued from a mathematical modeling point of view that you might be able to eliminate HIV in a decade or reduce greatly the spread of the epidemic. Now, there's a lot of assumptions in that model.
Mm-hmm.
My job is to prove or disprove the assumptions. Okay. So I'm not a mathematical modeler or an assumption guy. I'm an investigator. So the trials we do are really designed to prove or disprove the assumptions. So we've been working, and if you look at the groups at UNC, they're really basic scientists and clinical investigators and pharmacologists and epidemiologists all working together to prove or disprove assumptions to set the stage for these broader trials, that is community-based trials, or inform public health policy.
Sure. So how is that model being tested at this point?
Good question.
And do you think there's a...
excellent question. Okay, so let me fill you in on that.
Okay.
So the first issue is, are the assumptions correct? In fact, I would say narcissistically that a lot of the assumptions were built on work that was done at UNC in terms of what happens when you start antiviral therapy in terms of suppression of viremia in the genital secretions.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to demonstrate in a whole series of articles that we can, using the right drugs, we can achieve terrific suppression of viremia, even in, and thereby probably rendering people less contagious. This led to this gigantic clinical trial in 9 countries called HPTN-052, mm-hmm. which is designed to enroll nearly 2,000 couples to understand whether if the infected person takes their pills reliably, whether we've rendered them not contagious. That's the assumption.
That's a key question.
That's
too,
an unbelievably key question.
Yeah.
That trial has enrolled about almost 1,000 couples. It's going to run for 7 years, though. There's another part of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough just to suppress viremia for a year or two. We need durable suppression of viremia. If it's not durable, all we'll do is end up with a delayed transmission event.
Sure.
Now, because the belief systems are so strong about this, we see movement towards community trials. So, and I'll be specific. So in British Columbia, a guy named Julio Montaner, strongly believing that the idea is right, intends to try and treat everybody in British Columbia and demonstrate that by treating everybody in, finding and treating everybody in British Columbia, that in fact this will lead to a recognition of the public health benefit of antiviral therapy. A similar kind of trial is being proposed by the Harvard faculty for Botswana. So we see the roots of giant community trials trying to prove treatment is prevention proving the Granich model. I'm very enthusiastic about this, but my job, again, is to complete the work we started to prove that the assumptions are correct. And if they're not correct, understand why they're not correct.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem we have is substantial. What about acute infection? Those people are always invisible to testing. So even if we treat everybody, and how important are people with acute infection to the epidemic? Well, in most models, anywhere from 8 to 40% of all the infections that occur in a community occur from people with acute infection. So even if we deal with all the established infections with treatment at the time people are detected, we still need to focus on acute infection.
So that would tend to lend some more credence to treatment as prophylaxis then, would it not?
Well, they're complementary. Treatment as prophylaxis we expect will work, but that'll be adjunctive. In the end of the day, we have a series of challenges. And it brings me back to that the only perfect solution is a vaccine. There's two perfect solutions. Absolutely. Curing the infection or making a vaccine that's 100% effective. That has to be our – we can't let our eyes leave that ball.
Right.
That is what we need to work on, cure and a vaccine.
I see. Well, you know, the idea of giving everyone in British Columbia or, for that matter, Botswana.
Everyone infected. Everyone infected.
Right. Oh, okay.
Not
okay.
Everyone in the province. Everyone who's HIV. You're not going to put the species awash in drugs.
Okay.
Only
okay,
the people okay. who are HIV infected.
I see.
So they have to be detected and then treated immediately.
Now, what are the ethical implications of that question? Because I know that the idea of treating someone who isn't ill brings up some ethical issues.
It's interesting. This is a pendulum. 10 years ago, it was like, well, you can't treat people too early because the drugs will make people sick and they're too expensive. Now it's all reversed. Now it's like, why wouldn't you treat somebody as soon as you detect them? Because it must be good to suppress the virus. So I don't. There is no ethical issue. There is the issue of proving or disproving that very early treatment is of substantial benefit. Now, let me say UNC has participated, to be fair about this, we've participated in an observational set of studies called, and Joe Iron, who's a big leader of our clinical activities, he's participated in a study called NA Accord. And they've looked at observational data from many thousands of patients managed all over the United States and Canada, and they conclude that early treatment is life-saving, even at very high CD4 counts. There is substantial evidence, at least observational evidence, that early treatment's good for you.
So the person who might be listening who perhaps has recently had a test and
they should,
back positive.
But, well, let's look at two scenarios.
Okay.
If they've had the test in North Carolina and the test is said to be negative, there's something special I need to say. First of all, in North Carolina, we look at the antibody. So they're negative by antibody, established infection. But we also look for all acute infections in North Carolina. So if your test comes back negative in North Carolina, you're negative. Mm-hmm. There's no virus in your blood, and your antibody's negative. It's the only state that I'm aware of in the country that has such an extensive effort to find everybody. So the testing in North Carolina is terrific. And we'd like to test everyone once a year in the right age groups. Now, if your test comes back positive, the goal then is to try and avoid the kind of massive fear of stigma and fear of disease that might... First, the testing is prevented by these kind of fears. That's irrational to the extent that if you had chest pain today, you'd probably get a cardiologist to see you, and you'd probably get a stent and say, well, I got a stent. I'm in good shape. If you're HIV infected and you're tested early, it's the same. You know, we convert this from a disease that might be life-threatening 5 years from now to a chronic and manageable disease today. So so I think the barrier to testing is no longer money. It's not the money to get the test. It's cheap or free. Mm-hmm. And it's not the drugs. The drugs are now free for the most part in North Carolina. We have a support program. So if you have no insurance, the state will provide the money for the drugs. And there's no waiting list. So the big issue is getting everybody tested who under the appropriate circumstances. So if you're positive, there's plenty of opportunity to get into care in virtually every health department in the state and in the major medical centers all over the state.
I see.
It's not a problem in the United States.
So should that person start ART immediately?
No, no one would do that. I don't think anyone would do that in the United States today. This is all by way of discussion.
Okay.
The person who finds themselves to be HIV infected today, they would be given an option of starting therapy immediately if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But not all insurance companies would pay for it.
I see.
Then they'd be followed carefully until their CD4 count fell, but to a very modest level, fell to a level of 350, which is way above the level where we normally see opportunistic infections. Mm-hmm. Then they would be started. Now, a year or 2 years from now, this may change. But right now, we're in this window of discussion.
And that's the debate where
that's the debate
as to what the gold standard really.
It's not a debate. We're gathering data to evolve the gold standard. The gold standard is not the gold standard anymore, right? Mm-hmm. It used to be silver. Now it's gold.
Right.
Who knows what gold's worth today? So,
Mike, I wanted to ask you about some of the other strategies we've heard so much about in recent years. Regarding HIV and AIDS, such as condom use. Male circumcision has gotten a lot of attention. And, you know, dare we just overlook the idea of abstinence and promotion of that? Actually, where do those modalities fit?
It's interesting because we reverse the normal way. If I was giving a lecture on this, which I have to do about 2,000 times a year, if I'm giving a lecture about this, normally I start with the first opportunity is the person who's HIV negative. How do you remain HIV negative? See, we started with the discussion of the moment of exposure. Mm-hmm. At the moment of exposure, that's where antivirals and vaccines are important, or innate immunity. After you're infected, that's where treatment comes in. But really, most of our energy and a ton of our money has been spent on the HIV negative person. How do you remain HIV negative? Well, as you've just pointed out, if you're abstinent and not using drugs, you're not going to acquire HIV. If you're not using IV drugs and you're not going to get blood transfused in the poorest countries in the world, and even there the blood supplies are generally safe. So this is 85% is a sexually transmitted disease, and if you have no sex, there's no HIV.
Sure.
Now, the problem with abstinence, of course, is it's hard to establish. Even for those who would prefer to be abstinent. So then we have a couple. The problem with couples is, and this is an important issue, is it's hard to know you're in a monogamous relationship. And I don't say that disparaging of our faithfulness and fidelity, but a lot of times we see concurrency. That is, there's a couple is really a triad or more. and in Africa, this is a particular problem because being faithful can be fatal. The woman might be faithful to the husband. Maybe the husband's not faithful to the woman. So the woman who wants to have a baby, she's infected through no promiscuity. She's infected by her husband. So as you point out, we have a device that's virtually perfect, condoms. If you use condoms 100% of the time and use them properly, HIV goes away. The problem is, it's difficult to use them properly, and it's difficult to use them 100% of the time. And if you want to procreate, you can't use condoms. Sure. So that brings us to other barrier methods. And the barrier method that's proved to work fantastically well is circumcision. So let's just talk about that for a second. So we knew that we were seeing much less HIV in parts of the world where circumcision was popular compared to places where circumcision was rare. But then 3 randomized trials were done, all in sub-Saharan Africa, and all 3 trials demonstrated about a 60% reduction by the man who was circumcised after healing of acquisition of HIV. And certainly that can be ascribed to skin forming over what was previously mucosa or foreskin. So that's a terrific intervention, but it's challenging to circumcise enough people to benefit the epidemic.
I see.
But yet, and about 80% of men in the United States are circumcised. So we're already way ahead of the curve in terms of the benefits of circumcision.
Right. I know that was just fascinating when that came out, that really does have a tangible
It was kind of benefit. Expected because if you have skin is so impermeable compared to mucosa. So it was not a shock that circumcision worked. We just didn't know how well it would work. And 70% is very attractive.
Indeed.
And there are – Gates Foundation has funded massive rollout of circumcision. They're trying to undertake millions of circumcisions. The problem is in India and China, this is going to be very difficult to benefit. Because the Indians, because of difference of religious beliefs, Hindus versus Muslims, they're right now not very enthusiastic about circumcision, and the Chinese are not that enthusiastic about circumcision. So the benefits are mostly going to be delivered in sub-Saharan Africa.
Sure. Well, with sub-Saharan Africa in mind, one thing I did want to definitely ask you about is how are we doing particularly there in terms of distribution of antiretroviral drugs and costs? And that's been such a controversy over the years. Is it that situation improving?
The PEPFAR, the Presidential Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and the other global funds available have made a huge difference. And we're treating at least a couple of million people in sub-Saharan Africa. But still, of the people recognized with infection, at least another 3 million need antivirals today. So we've made tremendous strides, but we have a ways further to go. The biggest problem is lack of testing. Even in that hyper-endemic area, probably no more than 15% of people have been tested. So you've got huge numbers of people who are developing advanced disease who've never been tested and are not being treated. So I think in order for antiviral therapy in Africa, it's not just about the drugs, it's about the testing. And it's the stigma and the barriers to testing we need to overcome and overwhelm. Now, let me say that where we have made huge strides is in moms. So pregnant women, of course, about anywhere from 15 to 20% are infected, and we know we can prevent their baby from getting infected with the right interventions. And testing for moms has improved dramatically. Prevention activities for moms has improved dramatically, and UNC is involved in a gigantic study that'll be the results of which will be announced this summer in Cape Town, South Africa, about the best way to prevent transmission from mom to baby.
I see, and I know that's a very important issue.
It's really important. Charlie Vanderhorst has led a giant trial with the U.S. CDC of 2,700 mothers that's coming to closure July 16th.
I see.
I know the date.
Excellent. Well, we'll be keeping an eye out for that for sure. Mike, in just the very few minutes we have left, I want to give you the opportunity to tell us a little bit more about the Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases, which you direct, about the various programs that the Institute has going on. And I was curious, just in looking at it, is it a bricks and mortar center, or is it a virtual collaboration?
No, bricks and mortar. We'd like it if you would like to build it. We'll live in it. But it's a little. It's not. UNC has a terrific campus. Institute is designed to facilitate the goals of all the health sciences schools and collaborate and coordinate activities with the academic affairs, the rest of the campus, make the whole boat move down the stream faster. The goals are research, teaching, and education. There's a lot. There's a website. The most important thing, if somebody's really interested in global health at UNC, it's global health at UNC will bring you to our website.
Okay.
And that website summarizes a lot of our accomplishments, which are substantial.
And it's a great site, too, by the way.
Yeah, it's a very well-done site. Lisa Chensville manages the site. It's a terrific site. And there's a lot of opportunities for people in this community and our university to do things globally, and we try and make them aware through our website.
Terrific. Well, Dr. Mike Cohen, we have come to the end of our hour together, and I certainly appreciate you coming and joining us today, and best of luck in your ongoing efforts to rid the world of the scourge of HIV and AIDS.
Thank you for talking to me.
And we've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, as always, for the lineup of upcoming guests. So please join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.